Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 953. St. Bernard, the Rebel Without a Clue. This is being recorded on April 6th of the year 2017. This is a program at one level about Bernie Sanders, but at another level, and more importantly, I think, about some of the things that Sanders has been instrumental in doing, and even more importantly, about some of the things that the so-called progressive sector's inclination, or really obsession, with identity politics has left them open to. This really is a program that I was going to do a couple of shows about Bernie Sanders. This is a program, I think, I have a little more time. Well, not a question of time, but there are a great many other things that I think take precedence over this at this time, and I'm going to be getting to some of those. I think, though, against the background of things happening abroad, in particular the by now predictable knee-jerk response to a chemical weapons incident or another chemical weapons incident in Syria, the volatility of the American political and national security landscape is something that needs to be taken into account. And in particular, some of the people that have been moving into the Democratic Party or gaining ascendance in the Democratic Party, I think, bode very poorly for the future. Some musings on what I'm going to be talking about. It would be very wrong indeed to finger Bernie Sanders as the exclusive or even the primary vehicle for the implementation or the obsession, implementation of or obsession with identity politics in the Democratic Party and in the so-called progressive political sector. At this point, I think Bernie Sanders would get lost in a crowd. I also should perhaps remind people in passing that many of the policy positions that Bernie Sanders advocates are ones I would like to see implemented as well. I'd love to see a single-payer healthcare system and a virtually free college education for young people and a great many other things that Bernie advocates. I also would like to live forever, and I think there is about as much chance of those things happening as the odds of my living forever. In tribal societies, older folks are viewed as authoritative. That is not the case in our society, which is regrettable because young people have never been old, but old people have been young once. I'm not sure, being a member of the baby boom generation, I'm not sure how many of my fellow boomers ever really stopped being babies. Certainly an awful lot of them don't appear to have done that. In my headier moments, I like to think that I have steered clear of that. Watching the 2016 campaign was really something of a deja vu all over again experience. I felt like I was watching some aspects of the 1968 presidential contest and some of the 1972 campaign. And the whole thing had the deja vu feel. Although I'm sympathetic to the concept that black lives matter, I am suspicious of the movement as a whole, which had all of the trappings of a 1960s era domestic agent provocateur operation a la Symbionese Liberation Army, or perhaps some of the things like the zebra killings, which were never properly investigated here in the Bay Area. Watching the Black Lives Matter movement progress, I was just waiting, okay, how long is it going to be before we see the sort of polarization that we had in the 1960s? How long will it be before we see urban rioting and heavily armed tactical squad policemen and SWAT teams? Well, that happened right away. Not right away, but it didn't take long. Then how long is it going to be before we have so-called black militants going off and killing police? That didn't take too long either. The guy who went off in Dallas had been influenced by not only the Nation of Islam, but also a violent black and anti-Semitic group called the New Black Panthers. The fellow who went off in Baton Rouge, by the way, like the fellow who went off in Dallas, was a veteran. He was a black or African-American sovereign citizen. The sovereign citizens are one of these anti-government groups that basically don't feel they have any obligation to abide by various kinds of civic codes. The point being that both the Dallas and Baton Rouge gunmen had links to the right wing, and organizations like the Nation of Islam are basically African-American fascist organizations. Farrakhan's behavior vis-a-vis the assassination of Malcolm X is more than a little suspicious. The executive authority in the killing of Malcolm X, like so many of the other assassinations of the 60s, appears to have been elements of the intelligence community acting with the far right. And in the case of the killing of Malcolm X, the far right would include the Nation of Islam. It was very suspicious and suspicious of Al Sharpton, who was sort of the go-to guy now, the ubiquitous spokesman for the African-American community. According to an article by the late Warren Hinkle in the San Francisco Examiner, when it was a Hearst paper, Sharpton worked for the CIA in Grenada. It is a matter of public record that Sharpton is an FBI informant. If, in fact, he worked for CIA in Grenada, as that San Francisco Examiner article maintained, it is a pretty good bet that he works for CIA here in the U.S. Just watching the unfolding of the Black Lives Matter movement had a deja vu feel to it. I would note now not only that Donald Trump campaigned against the violence overtaking our cities, whereas in fact crime rates, urban crime rates, including those in African-American communities, have actually declined for the most part. The images coming out of Black Lives Matter once the thing unfolded were violent ones, and ours is no longer, if it ever was, a culture of ideas and concepts. It is a culture of images and sensations. The transition from reading and radio, in which words are the main carriers of information or conveyors of information, to first television and now mobile technology, mobile phones, and social media and other forms of glowing screens. Ours is a culture of images and sensations. Jeff Sessions, the more or less openly white supremacist attorney general, has promised to crack down on the violence in cities. Indeed, in his inaugural speech, Donald Trump made reference to that. In fact, again, urban violence has been declining, but the images coming out of Black Lives Matter resonated with a large part of the Trump constituency. Bernie Sanders reminded me in many ways of Eugene McCarthy. When I was a kid, a freshman in college, Eugene McCarthy, a Democratic senator from Minnesota, became the peace candidate. And young college students, including many who were affiliated with the anti-Vietnam War movement, began, quote, cleaning up for Gene, unquote. They cut their long hair and shaved off facial hair and dressed nicely so that they could go campaign for Eugene McCarthy, who scored an upset victory in the New Hampshire primary. Eventually, he went nowhere. The real peace candidate, Robert Kennedy, was assassinated in June of 1968. It ultimately came out that Eugene McCarthy was CIA. He's listed in Who's Who in the CIA, although the book has been dissed by the usual suspects, it's generally authoritative. One of the interesting things about Eugene McCarthy's 1968 campaign is that it was financed by a guy named Stuart Mott, last name M-O-T-T, whose family runs or owned, they may have been sold, a line of foods, apple foods, and grape foods. The family's main capital asset was a huge block of GM stock. At the same time that Stuart Mott was financing the, quote, peace, unquote, candidate Eugene McCarthy's 68 campaign, he was also financing the production of Mitchell Werbel's silenced submachine guns, the Ingram Mach 10 and Ingram Mach 11. The parent company of the Parabellum Corporation that cranked those out was called Environmental Industries Incorporated, which sounds really green. It was actually a grim joke. The idea was that they had a contribution to make in the area of population control. The fundamental discontinuity between the anti-Vietnam War stance of Eugene McCarthy and the fact that the fellow who was bankrolling his campaign, which at the time left me scratching my head, there were no antecedents to Eugene McCarthy's sudden ascendance. He basically came out of nowhere. Well, the money came from a guy who was also bankrolling the production of Mitch Werbel's machine guns, silenced machine guns. In 1980, Eugene McCarthy backed Ronald Reagan for president, which is a real peace-loving thing to do. This is all sort of long-winded. I had the same odd feeling about Bernie Sanders. Like, where did this guy come from? Why was he suddenly the go-to guy for the progressive sector? And I wondered who was behind him, what was really behind his ascent. Also, a lot of the people, at least here in California, who were gung-ho Bernie Sanders supporters were neither intellectually oriented nor politically oriented, at least the ones that I ran into. A lot of them were into music or other aspects of culture, but they were not really politically oriented. But, boy, they were wired on Bernie Sanders. I suspect that not only social media, but perhaps some of the artificial intelligence and the coupled billions of dollars in supercomputers and big data of Robert and Rebecca Mercer and Steve Bannon and Cambridge Analytica may have had something to do with that. The campaign is, of course, over, and although ultimately Bernie Sanders did wind up campaigning for Hillary Clinton, I think the damage that he did, where he sort of gave a lot of momentum to the crooked Hillary meme, then the fascist WikiLeaks network, which I've been warning about for many years and which emerged as the more or less above-ground dirty tricks component of the Trump campaign. WikiLeaks picked it up from there. I have noted, and there will be links in the description for this show, that Tulsi Gabbard, described at one point as a rising star in the Democratic Party and the former deputy chairperson for the Democratic Party, who has many links running to the far right, including the Hare Krishna cult, basically a fascist mind control cult, and her networking with Narendra Modi and the Hindu nationalist fascist RSS, the organization that murdered Mahatma Gandhi, and a number of other of Tulsi Gabbard's assignations are to be noted. She was a major factor in the momentum building of Bernie Sanders. She was being bruited about as his vice presidential candidate if he'd gotten a nomination, was a high-profile supporter, put his name in nomination at the Democratic Convention, and then was the write-in candidate for the Bernie or Bust campaigns in October and early November. Tulsi Gabbard's views and affiliations don't really make sense if you are a peace candidate and against wars of foreign intervention. You're not going to be doing many of the things that she did. She co-sponsored a piece of legislation which labels anyone who opposes the entry of Ukraine under the OUNB airs in Ukraine as a terrorist, unquote. This is a very interesting definition of a terrorist. And again, in, for the record, 941, 942, and 945, I note that the incoherent nature of Tulsi Gabbard's views. Ultimately, she was interviewed by Donald Trump, was reported as being considered for his UN ambassadorship. And again, I'll put links in the description for this program. Against the background of another chemical weapons incident in Syria, automatically being blamed on the Assad regime, whereas there really has not been time to do a serious ground-level investigation of an incident like that. And with the Syrian war landscape being not only extremely complex, but with players running from the Turkish government of Erdogan to the former al-Nusra Front and other Islamist elements affiliated with al-Qaeda, the players in the Syrian bloodbath that are capable and have shown a willingness to perpetrate an atrocity which would then be blamed on someone else and used to escalate U.S. military involvement there against Mr. Assad. Well, there is no shortage of those elements. Our media predictably have immediately pinned the responsibility for that on Assad, and Trump is now making all sorts of belligerent statements. I remember during the campaign as well how many people who really should have known better were lauding Trump's foreign policy and talking about how he represented an antidote to the anti-Russian hysteria, which, you know, rhetorically he certainly did. They lauded him for at least officially opposing our wars of regime change abroad. However, I noted during the campaign that if there was ever a political figure who was just ripe for manipulation by provocation, it was Donald Trump. And with the OUNB heirs in Ukraine being prone to provocation, and with the Al-Qaeda and other Islamist, quote, allies, unquote, that the U.S. has quietly embraced and that Turkey is openly sponsoring in Syria, the stage was set, and the stage is set for provocations in Syria, provocations in Ukraine or elsewhere. And maybe this is the fact that I'm getting older and I've seen so much of this before, but I just, listening to people anointing Donald Trump as the antidote to neocon Hillary Clinton, if there was ever someone who was ripe for manipulation by provocation, it is Donald Trump. Of the things that I'm going to talk about in connection with Bernie Sanders, and again, I was going to do two shows, but at this point I'm sort of reluctantly doing one because there are other things that I want to get into. But these are to be seen not only against the background of Trump's knee-jerk and predictably, characteristically vicious reactions to things like the chemical weapons attack in Syria. It turns out the 2013 sarin attack was not Assad at all, but may very well have come from Turkish intelligence. There simply has not been enough time to make a finding about the latest attack. One wonders why Mr. Assad would have picked this time to smash himself in the face with a cream pie. It reminds me of the, quote, hacks, unquote, into the Democratic National Committee's computers and into Mr. Podesta's computers. Those may not have been hacks at all, and if they were, they were almost certainly cyber false flag operations. No intelligence service behaves the way Russian intelligence allegedly behaved, going, yoo-hoo, here we are, we're hacking the Democratic National Committee, you know, make sure you got it, this is us, this is Russia, unless it is a rival intelligence service engaged in a false flag operation.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Some of my musings, and they're going to be attenuated about Bernie Sanders and some of the things he's doing, should be seen against this background and against the background of Mr. Sebastian Gorka. Yet another article about Gorka, this also from the Forward, also by Lili, L-I-L-I, Bayer, B-A-Y-E-R, from the Forward of April 3rd of 2017. Exclusive, controversial Trump aide Sebastian Gorka backed violent anti-Semitic militia. Now note who Sebastian Gorka, what Sebastian Gorka is. We've spoken about this before. As a Hungarian political leader in 2007, Sebastian Gorka, President Trump's chief counterterrorism advisor, publicly supported a violent racist and anti-Semitic paramilitary militia that was later banned as a threat to minorities by multiple court rulings. In a video obtained by the Forward of an August 2007 television appearance by Gorka, the future White House senior aide explicitly affirms his party's and his support for the black-vested Hungarian Guard or Magyar Garda, a group later condemned by the European Court of Human Rights for attempting to promote an essentially racist legal order. Asked directly on the TV interview program if he supports the move by Jobbik, a far-right anti-Semitic party, to establish the militia, Gorka, appearing as a leader of his own newly formed party, replies immediately, "That is so." The Guard, Gorka explains, is a response to a big societal need. The Guard was based, in many ways, on the Hungarian Arrow Cross. That was a Hungarian fascist organization allied with Adolf Hitler. The liaison between the Arrow Guard and Hitler was a guy named Laszlo Pastor, who then jumped to U.S. intelligence and to the Republican Party, and he was the point element of the Republican Ethnic Heritage Outreach Council, literally a Nazi branch of the Republican Party, featuring not only Arrow Cross veterans, but the Romanian Iron Guard, Bulgarian National Front, and chiefly the OUNB from Ukraine. Basically, Pastor went from being the liaison between Hitler and the Arrow Cross to being the liaison between the Republican Party and not only the post-war Arrow Cross, but other Eastern European fascist organizations associated with the Galen spy outfit and the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. The potential volatility that someone like Gorka offers or brings to the landscape is something that we should not discount. Again, I am not obviously impressed with Bernie Sanders at all, although I agree with many of his policy positions. Younger people who were attracted to Bernie Sanders, and I can understand that, would do well to take some advice from a senior advisor. This is not a tribal society. We have no council of elders, but to take it from someone who is 7 years younger than Bernie Sanders, he is profoundly immature for a man his age to have as little on the ball as Bernie Sanders does. Well, the guy never really grew up politically, or I don't think personally. Bernie Sanders was not a member of the Democratic Party until a little over a year before he ran for the nomination, and he left the Democratic Party in late July of last year. He's not even a member of the Democratic Party. What he was in 1980 was a presidential elector for the Socialist Workers' Party. An article from Slate magazine by Michelle Goldberg from February 24th of 2016. In 1980, Sanders served as an elector for the Socialist Workers' Party, which was founded on the principles of Leon Trotsky. According to the New York Times, that party called for abolishing the military budget. It also called for solidarity, unquote, with the revolutionary regimes in Iran, Nicaragua, Grenada, and Cuba. This was in the middle of the Iranian hostage crisis. Those things are the kinds of things that would have been bruited about if Bernie Sanders had gotten the nomination, which he was not about to do. I wondered when Sanders emerged as the main rival to Hillary Clinton, I wondered who was behind him. In the description for the show, I'm not going to go into this due to the limitations of time. I would note that the Socialist Workers' Party is a Trotskyite political party. It was one of the institutional affiliations that gave Lee Harvey Oswald his left cover. It also was widely infiltrated not only by spooks, but by Nazis looking to give themselves a left cover. Also, there is a passage from a book that is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website, my blog. It's called The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Rees, published in hardcover in 1944. And it notes that the Nazis, including Heinrich Himmler, head of the SS, and Rudolf Hess, the head of the Ostministerium of the Third Reich, were admirers of Trotsky's methodology. Hitler himself, however, I should say, in addition, also felt that the Nazis had much to learn from Trotsky. "You should read his books," Hitler barked. "We can learn a lot from him." And this passage goes into how the Nazis looked to Trotsky's movement as a template to build their own underground infiltration of organizations that they planned on conquering. I wonder to what extent not only the SWP, but perhaps Bernie Sanders, was targeted for manipulation by elements like that. I mention that because Bernie Sanders not only was a vocal, high-profile supporter of Keith Ellison to be head of the Democratic National Committee. He narrowly lost. He is now the deputy chair of the DNC, the same post held by Tulsi Gabbard, who I feel was an infiltrator. But the head of the Vermont Democratic Party now is a guy named Faisal Gill. Faisal Gill is a protege of Grover Norquist and was the operations director of Grover Norquist's Islamic Free Market Institute. One of the things that did not get a lot of publicity during the campaign was the fact that among the financiers of Bernie Sanders' campaign was American Crossroads. That was Karl Rove's super PAC. Sanders also received financing from Paul Singer, a billionaire hedge fund kingpin. I wonder, although there is no way of verifying this, I wonder to what extent the much ballyhooed small anonymous donations that financed Bernie Sanders' campaign were actually being laundered through American Crossroads. Of Karl Rove, American Crossroads, and their support for the Sanders campaign, from the Daily Beast of February 22nd of 2016, article by Jackie Kucinich, Bernie Sanders' conservative fanboys. American Crossroads, founded by former Bush advisor Karl Rove and several other conservative-backed super PACs, have spent the last month intentionally fueling the burn. But their zeal has more to do with an effort to weaken Hillary Clinton, whom they still see as the likely Democratic nominee and harder to defeat in the general election. In the wake of Clinton's close Nevada win, Crossroads claimed credit for driving her numbers down in favor of Sanders, skipping down. On Monday, Future 45, a super PAC reportedly backed by hedge fund billionaire Paul Singer, launched the latest in its own series of ads that seemed to defend Sanders. Sanders also was backing the establishment of open primaries throughout. This was a permitted Republicans to basically choose the Democratic candidate. Again, Bernie Sanders was a big backer of Keith Ellison, as we have looked at. In For the Record 950, Keith Ellison not only has, well, we looked at this in 941 and in 950 as well. There will be links in the description. Keith Ellison has one foot in the Nation of Islam and another foot in the Muslim Brotherhood. It would be difficult to imagine a background more suited to manipulation by provocation and to public relations hype by the likes of Sebastian Gorka or Fox News or any number of other elements than having, again, an African-American Muslim with one foot in the Nation of Islam and another in the Muslim Brotherhood as the head of the Democratic National Committee. Now he is the vice chair of the committee. Again, we noted in For the Record 950 that Faisal Gill, a protege of Grover Norquist, is now the head of the Vermont Democratic Party. They're viewing this as this sends a message to Trump. No, what it does is it sets up the Democrats for manipulation via provocation and for the invocation of identity politics to trash the Democrats. At some point, people are going to wake up to the consequences of what the Trump administration is doing. A lot of it may take some time to manifest, gutting environmental regulations and permitting corporations to put whatever they want into whatever product they wish to put it in. That will take some time to manifest when people start getting cancer like crazy or when freeways start collapsing and they can't get any health care and there's no money to do that. Well, we'll see what happens. At some point, people are going to start screaming bloody murder. When that happens, the GOP is not going to be in a position to campaign on the issues. They will play the race card, they will play the Islamic terror card, or something along those lines. We're going to go back to For the Record 467, recorded on Independence Day of 2004. Remember that a Grover Norquist protege is now the head of the Vermont Democratic Party, and he previously held a sensitive position with the Department of Homeland Security. He then jumped from the Republicans to the Democrats. We now have a Grover Norquist protege in as head of the Vermont Democratic Party.
This is from Salon Magazine of June 22nd of 2004. This article is by Mary Jacoby. It's titled, How Secure is the Department of Homeland Security? Subtitled, Senior Homeland Security Official Faisal Gill failed to disclose that he worked for an American Muslim leader now in jail on terrorism charges. By the way, that Muslim leader is Abdurrahman Alamoudi, an intimate of Youssef Nada and Ahmed Idris Nasruddin of the Al-Taqwa Network, as we've seen in many programs. Just go to the Spitfire website and do a search on Alamoudi, A-L-A-M-O-U-D-I. And you will locate that. His first name, by the way, is spelled differently in different programs. Again, from Salon 622-2004, article by Mary Jacoby, How Secure is the Department of Homeland Security? By the way, as we get into this, pay particular attention to the wording of some documents that were taken from the home of Sami Al-Arian, the investigation into whom led to the Operation Green Quest raids of 3-22-2002. It specifically alludes to the necessity of Islamists infiltrating American intelligence services in order to basically gain expertise. Again, like I say, fifth column. This article reads in part, The policy director for the Department of Homeland Security's Intelligence Division was briefly removed from his job in March when the Federal Bureau of Investigation discovered he had failed to disclose his association with Abdurrahman Alamoudi, a jailed American Muslim leader. Alamoudi was indicted last year on terrorism-related money laundering charges and now claims to have been part of a plot to assassinate Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Abdullah. After a flurry of interagency meetings, however, Homeland Security decided to leave the policy director, Faisal Gill, in place, according to two government officials with knowledge of the Alamoudi investigation. A White House political appointee with close ties to Republican power broker Grover Norquist and no apparent background in intelligence, Gill has access to top-secret information on the vulnerability of America's seaports, aviation facilities, and nuclear power plants to terrorist attacks. This last sentence, again, because it's a beaut. A White House political appointee with close ties to Republican power broker Grover Norquist and no apparent background in intelligence, Gill has access to top-secret information on the vulnerability of America's seaports, aviation facilities, and nuclear power plants to terrorist attacks. The FBI raised concerns with Homeland Security officials in March after discovering that Gill had failed to list on security clearance documents his work in 2001 with the American Muslim Council, the officials said. The advocacy group, which was controlled by Alamoudi, has been under scrutiny in an investigation of terrorism financing. The lead agent in that investigation works for an arm of Homeland Security. Gill's omission of the information on his standard Form 86 national security questionnaire is a potential felony violation. There is no evidence, however, that Gill has taken any action to compromise national security. A Department of Homeland Security spokesman would not comment on Gill or when he was hired, except to say that a, quote, thorough investigation, unquote, by the department's Office of Security found no basis to deny the 32-year-old lawyer a security clearance. Among Gill's political patrons is Grover Norquist, head of Americans for Tax Reform and a key ally of the White House. Gill listed Norquist as a reference on employment documents, the government officials said. Gill also worked in 2001 for a Muslim political outreach organization that Norquist co-founded with a former top aide to Al-Amudi. Interrupting, that is the Islamic Institute, one of whose directors was former Harkin Energy Director and Bush ally Talat Otman, who interceded on behalf of the individuals and institutions busted by the Operation Green Quest raids of 3/20/2002. Skipping down. Mark Zaid, a lawyer in private practice in Washington who specializes in security clearance cases, said it would be unusual for an agency to overlook omissions on a security clearance application. Quote, most agencies get really upset and suspicious and act antagonistically toward applicants if they find they withheld information, unquote, he said, adding that a minor violation might be forgiven. But he said if the issue concerned failing to list employment at, quote, a terrorist organization, or one that's being investigated, all sorts of red flags would go up, unquote. Gill's placement in the sensitive intelligence job has alarmed government officials because it fits the operating theory of prosecutors and investigators that Al-Amudi was part of a long-term scheme by Islamic extremists to place friendly, if perhaps unwitting, associates in key U.S. government positions, i.e., I would add parenthetically, a fifth column. Now, note the wording of documents that were taken from the home of Sami Al-Arian, a professor of computer science, an intimate of this same milieu, an associate of the Bush White House. Listen closely to the way these documents are worded. A document seized in a 1995 raid of a close Al-Amudi friend and political ally, former University of South Florida professor Sami Al-Arian, outlined a plan to, quote, infiltrate the sensitive intelligence agencies or the embassies in order to collect information and build close relationships with the people in charge of these establishments, unquote. The unsigned document, which authorities believe was authored by Al-Arian in part because it was found among his papers, added, quote, We are in the center which leads the conspiracy against our Islamic world. Our presence in North America gives us a unique opportunity to monitor, explore, and follow up, unquote. It instructed members of the center, unquote, thought to refer to an Islamic think tank that Al-Arian founded, to collect information from those relatives and friends who work in sensitive positions in government, unquote. Al-Arian is in a Florida prison awaiting trial next year on charges he was the North American leader of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, a group that has targeted Israel with suicide bombings. He denies all the charges, but investigators believe Al-Arian and Al-Amudi were part of a broader political Islamic movement in the United States that connects sympathizers of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and Al-Qaeda. This movement, the Muslim Brotherhood, is the umbrella under which terror groups have forged, quote, a significant degree of cooperation and coordination within our borders, unquote, former White House counterterrorism chief Richard Clark told the Senate Banking Committee last year. Again, quoting, the common link here is the extremist Muslim Brotherhood. All of these organizations are descendants of the membership and ideology of the Muslim Brothers, unquote. Al-Amudi, for example, has spoken openly of his admiration for the anti-Israeli Hamas, which evolved from a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. Al-Arian's circle of associates, meanwhile, overlaps with members of the Brooklyn, New York precursor to Al-Qaeda that was responsible for the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. The ties among Al-Amudi, the Muslim Brotherhood, and Gill help explain why officials are concerned about whether Gill was adequately vetted. These relationships are difficult to understand without immersion in the indictments, court transcripts, and case exhibits The concerned officials said they fear that busy political operatives in the administration simply do not grasp the national security issues at stake. Parenthetically, I would add that also applies for the vast majority of researchers and people involved in the 9/11 truth movement. They've missed this one completely. Continuing, there's an overall denial in the administration that the agenda being pushed by Norquist might be a problem, unquote, one official said. Again, quoting, "It's so absurd that a Grover Norquist person could even be close to something like this. That's really what's so insidious," unquote. And by the way, I would note that this Islamist GOP connection, in my opinion, one of the most important aspects of the September 11th investigation, has been, for all intents and purposes, completely overlooked by the so-called progressive sector. In fact, many of the people, such as Sami Al-Arian, have been hailed as political martyrs, etc. The criticism of this has come from some mainstream sources, some people within the intelligence community, but interestingly enough, the criticism of this insidious connection comes from some conservatives and also from moderate Muslims who've noted not only that the activities of people like Al-Amudi and the AMC are suspicious, but they have also noted, to their great credit, that many of the organizations that have emerged as advocacy organizations for the Muslim community in the United States are not representative of all at all of the Muslim community, but rather are extremist groups, no more representative of the average Muslim or Arab than the fascist party in Italy or the Nazi party in Germany were representative of the average Italian or German. Returning to the Salon article and of the criticism of AMC and these elements by Muslim and Arab sources who were previously involved with them, in 1999, a group of reformers ousted Al-Amudi as AMC executive director amid questions about the group's opaque finances and mysterious Middle Eastern funding sources. Al-Amudi took a position at the affiliated American Muslim Foundation, but remained in control of the AMC through friendly board members, the reformers said. Quote, "I had concerns about the reluctance to reveal information about the finances. They said they're not doing well, that they needed more money, but I looked at their office in Washington and it was very big," said one of the would-be reformers, Ikram Khan, a surgeon in Las Vegas. Khan said he resigned from the AMC board when his friend, Nazir Khaja, a Pakistani-American physician from California who was trying to open the group's books, told him that Al-Amudi was not cooperating. Again quoting, "I said, if this is the case, I cannot serve in the group," unquote, "and I sent in my resignation letter," Khan said. Skipping down again, "Now, the U.S. Justice Department is examining whether Al-Amudi was conspiring with a London group the Saudi government says is linked to Osama bin Laden. Who is Abdurrahman Al-Amudi? We really don't know," one of the concerned government officials said. "So how can we say there is not a problem with his former aide? He, Gil, has access to information about all our vulnerabilities, aviation, ports. He knows what is protected and what is not," unquote. Skipping down again, of Norquist and the development of the Islamist GOP connection. Yet some officials remain concerned that Gil apparently enjoys the political protection of Norquist, the architect of the 1994 Republican election sweep that brought Georgia Republican Newt Gingrich to power as House Speaker. Norquist speaks of, quote, crushing, unquote, his political opponents, and dismisses those who don't agree with his anti-tax, anti-government agenda as Bolsheviks, unquote. His power derives from a formidable coalition of evangelical, business, and other conservative groups that he controls to push favored GOP issues, as well as from his close relationship with White House political chief Karl Rove. In 1998, Norquist and a former deputy to Al-Amudi at the AMC co-founded the non-profit Islamic Institute as part of a drive to win Muslim voters for Bush in 2000. Al-Amudi donated $35,000 to the Institute, records show. Soon, the Islamic Institute, the AMC, and Al-Arian were all working together on a top priority for American Muslims, an end to the use of classified intelligence to jail non-citizens as national security threats. Al-Arian's brother-in-law had been jailed on the basis of such secret evidence linking him to Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and Al-Arian lobbied heavily on Capitol Hill to end the practice. In October of 2000, through the efforts of Norquist and Rove, Bush came out against secret evidence in a debate with Al Gore, and the AMC endorsed Bush for president. Al-Arian would later claim that the Muslim votes he rounded up for Bush in Florida helped decide the election. Gill was in the middle of these advocacy efforts. As director of government affairs at Norquist Islamic Institute, Gill lobbied against the use of secret evidence, according to a May 2001 release on the Institute's website. After the September 11, 2001 attacks, Gill was quoted in news articles as a spokesman for the AMC. A Washington Post article from May 2001, meanwhile, identified Gill as a spokesman for the, quote, fledgling, unquote, Taxpayers Alliance of Prince William County, Virginia, which is affiliated with Norquist's Americans for Tax Reform. According to the Post article, Norquist was slated to appear with Gill at an anti-tax rally.
That begins from For the Record 467 from July 4th of 2004. I also note, and this is in the description for the program, that Graham E. Fuller, who wrote the paper that launched the, credited with launching the Iran-Contra affair, one of the Muslim Brotherhood's chief advocates in the U.S. intelligence community, and someone who is a person of interest in the Boston Marathon bombing, deeply affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood and with Islamists, was also a backer of Bernie Sanders. And it's odd, Graham Fuller talked about being galvanized by Bernie Sanders' campaign. As we will indicate in the description to the show, the values that Bernie Sanders espouses are the opposite of those espoused by Graham Fuller. That's why Graham Fuller is a backer of the Muslim Brotherhood and their corporatist economics. The point being that with Karl Rove and Grover Norquist now looming in the background of either the Sanders machine and or the elevation of Faisal Gill to head the Vermont Democratic Party, we're seeing the two people most involved with the coalescing of the Islamic Free Market Institute, which was the focal point, many of whose members were the focal point of the Operation Green Quest raids in March of 2002. With Graham E. Fuller, we have arguably the intelligence community's number one advocate for the Muslim Brotherhood, also saying nice things about Bernie Sanders. What I wonder is this. Are the Democrats being set up to become the terror party in the event of some sort of horror show or a series of horror shows in the U.S.? I think we need to be on guard for that. And given the viciously adolescent nature of our political culture, I think the dangers are very extreme. And with people like Sebastian Gorka ruling the roost in the counter-terror establishment of the Trump White House, I don't think we can be too careful. Again, in tribal societies, older folks were, their opinions were valued because older people were young once, but young people have never been old. By way of gaining some perspective, when Bernie Sanders was running as a presidential elector for the Trotskyite Socialist Workers' Party, which is simply an idiotic thing to do. I read some of the things they espoused. It would have made him unelectable had he gotten the Democratic nomination. I don't think that was ever a possibility. In fact, I think his goal was basically, the goal of the people backing him, like Karl Rove, was to weaken Hillary Clinton. However, at the same time that Bernie Sanders was serving as a presidential elector for the Socialist Workers' Party, I was doing what you're about to listen to. This is excerpted from Uncle Sam and the Swastika, May 23rd, 1980. You'll also hear the voice of my former co-host, Mark Ortiz.
Before we conclude, in evaluating the forces that had led to the defeat of his group's efforts to bring about German reform, James Stuart Martin feared two things. First, he was afraid that the return to power of Hitler's industrialists would lead to a resurgence of Nazism in Germany. And more importantly, Martin noted that the same pattern of economic concentration that led to the ascendance of Hitler in Germany was already evident in the United States in 1950, and he expressed his fear that this concentration of power might lead to the rise of Nazism in this country. Martin concludes All Honorable Men by discussing the economics of fascism and his fears for both Germany and the U.S.
Dave and I are going to take turns reading you James Martin's conclusion in All Honorable Men. First, though, we'd like to remind you that we're reading a book written in 1950, and some of Martin's references to German Reconstruction date this text. However, we both feel that Martin's message about the dangers inherent in economic concentration is still as valid as ever.
Proceeding with the conclusion of All Honorable Men, James Stewart Martin writes, "After 2.5 years, I came back from Germany quite well aware that I had been wrestling with a buzzsaw. We had not been stopped in Germany by German business. We had been stopped in Germany by American business. The forces that had stopped us had operated from the United States, but had not operated in the open. We were not stopped by a law of Congress, by an executive order of the President, or even by a change of policy approved by the President or any member of his cabinet. In short, whatever it was that had stopped us was not the government, but it clearly had command of channels through which the government normally operates. The relative powerlessness of governments in the face of growing economic power is, of course, not new. Between the two world wars, the outstanding development in world economics was the division of territories and markets, a private agreement among the largest corporations of Britain, Germany, and the United States, with minor participations by their counterparts in France, Italy, and Japan. National governments stood on the sidelines while bigger operators arranged the world's affairs.
We have the same difficulty today. What we need is to be able to have a government that controls economic power instead of becoming its tool. Since power is a public trust, including economic power, the first job of a government is to see that the power is used in the public interest and not against it. By chartering a private corporation, a government delegates to the corporate body some of its own power to regulate commerce. Strictly speaking, this is an abdication by the government. It is time to view the results of this abdication by constitutional governments in favor of private governments. The occupation of Germany has already provided a good laboratory in which we could study the activities of self-centered corporations and the activities of a German national government in which these corporate combines had a dominant influence."
The eco-political masters of Germany boosted Hitler and his program into the driver's seat at a time when the tide in the political fight between the Nazis and the supporters of the Weimar Republic was swinging against the Nazis. All of the men who mattered in banking and industrial circles could quickly agree on one program and throw their financial weight behind it. Their support won the election for the Nazis. We must assume that the same thing is not yet true in the United States. We do have economic power so concentrated that it would lie in the power of a group of not more than 100 men, if they could agree among themselves, to throw the same kind of combined economic weight behind a single program. They have not agreed yet. There are still enough divisions within the Republican Party and enough minor differences between Republicans and Democrats to indicate that on some fundamental economic questions there are different points of view, each one championed by a different faction inside the financial and industrial community itself. If the United States should run into serious economic difficulties, however, most of the conditions for a reenactment of the German drama would already exist on the American stage. The slight differences within the camp of the fraternity then may be the only real barrier to the kind of integration of the financial and industrial community behind a single repressive program like that which the financiers and industrialists of Germany executed through Hitler. Are we safe in assuming that it would take a grave economic crisis to precipitate the dangers inherent in economic concentration? The basic integration of the financial and industrial groups in the United States is evident when we look at the increase of concentration in the past few years.
Our job now, then, is to prepare for a future crisis before it happens. This means that in Germany we must have a double objective. The occupation of Germany must be put back on the track. But more than that, we have to reassert public goals in the United States, which will prevent the already apparent concentration of economic power in our own country from reaching the end it did in Germany. We cannot hope to deal with the concentration of economic power in Germany until we are able to deal with the concentration of economic power in the United States. This brings the German problem home with an urgency that has been missing in most post-war discussions about Germany. The need to treat Germany as an American problem was not felt in this country after World War I. Despite warnings from men whose experience with the German occupation had convinced them that we were entering a period of armed truce and not peace, business arrangements went ahead unchecked to rebuild a Germany that could not be expected to be anything but a steamroller. Now, with all that experience and warning behind us, and in spite of strong popular support for the reform of Germany, we have had to watch the same errors being repeated as if nothing else were possible. The moral of this is not that Germany is an inevitable menace, but that there are forces in our own country which can make Germany a menace. And more importantly, those forces could create a menace of their own here at home. Not through a deliberate plot to bring about a political catastrophe, but as a calm judgment of business necessity. The men who might do this are not Nazis, but businessmen. Not criminals, but honorable men.
That began from Uncle Sam and the Swastika, May 23rd of 1980. Talking about how a concentration of economic power could lead to the rise of fascism implemented by businessmen. Aren't you glad that didn't happen? This concludes For the Record program number 953. St. Bernard, The Rebel Without a Clue, being recorded on April 6th of 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.